Welcome to the Nomi Key Show. I am Nomi Key Const. We are on day 151 of self-quarantine. This week, we have a very interesting show full of investigative reports. The first up on the show is Zach Coplin. He is an investigator at the Government Accountability Project. He just published a piece in the New Republic called How Taxpayer Dollars May Have Bought a Kurdish Strongman's Beverly Hills Mansion. What's interesting about this piece is he basically outlines how pay-to-play schemes work. It was very clear how they work with the U.S. government, how they work with the Department of Defense in making sure that a few oligarchs essentially are able to get a piece of the action, and in this case, it's specifically surrounding oil. Then we have an old friend, Nelson Dennis, who comes on briefly just to talk about the elections that have happened in are happening in Puerto Rico right now, in which there's always this conversation around independence and statehood. It's a really complicated issue for folks who are not from the island or familiar with the island's politics, but it has a significant impact on how the island receives any sort of support from the U.S. government, which treats it like a colony, is structured like a colony. And that leads us to the last investigative piece, which is by Adam Rhodes. He's our third guest, and he published a piece in BuzzFeed this week called As Puerto Rico Battles Hurricane Season, HIV-positive folks begin to brace for the worst. Yes, so many aspects. Interesting show. Great lineup, and if you're not already, make sure to join us on YouTube, subscribe, and like, and share. You can also go to patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. That's where you will get special content. But I have breaking news for everybody. Really exciting. Next week, starting August 17th, we are going to be hosting the DNC show. August 17th through the 21st, Monday through Friday, we'll be hosting a show right here on the Nomi Key Show on YouTube from 3 o'clock till 4 p.m. It is a special DNC show covering the convention. And then we're going to do it the next week for the Republican National Convention. Same time, same place, 5 days of shows per week. And if you're a patron, you're going to get extra content, long interviews. So if you're not a patron already, go to patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. That's how we are able to pay for these five-day-a-week shows. That's how we make it happen. So if you believe in the work we're doing and you want to see more of it, make sure to go to patreon.com/thenomikeyshow. And make sure to subscribe so you're aware of the shows that happen during the Democratic and Republican conventions. This last week, we saw some jaw-dropping results when it comes to progressive challengers. Of course, we saw Cori Bush, our sister, our comrade, who was a surrogate for Bernie Sanders, who has run for office before. She's a nurse. She's a single mother. She's a Black Lives Matter organizer. She, of course, shocked the world by defeating William Lacey Clay. But there was another shocker. This really blew everyone away. Marquita Bradshaw was running for U.S. Senate in Tennessee. Now, this is a state that was previously held 30 years ago, by Al Gore. Al Gore's family, Al Gore was a Democrat. He was the senator out of Tennessee, and his family had a legacy in that state. But since then, it has been a Republican state. Now, Marquita Bradshaw really shocked the world, not just because she won. She won by 9 points, but because she was outraised by 250-1. 250-1. James Mackler, who was one of Bradshaw's four primary competitors, was endorsed by the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, the DSCC for short. That is spearheaded by Senator Schumer. So I laugh because, you know, they focus on who is most likely going to win in the general election. How do we pick a candidate who can raise the money so they can go up against the Republican who's going to have a lot of money? And in their minds, of course, Tennessee was something worth investing in, was something that they thought that they could challenge the Republicans with. So they put $2 million. They supported this guy, James Mackler, as the nominee, full force supported, and he had over $2 million in his bank account. And Bradshaw, are you ready for it? She raised just over $8,400. Give it a minute, okay? So Bradshaw is a, not only is she a progressive, she supports Medicare for All, she supports the Green New Deal. This is, I don't think I've heard a bigger story in the last, 50 years. This in modern day politics, where money really helps get a candidate's name out there, where money pays for staff, where money makes sure that you have the data to target, you need to have a little bit. She has $8,400. This was a volunteer army. She not only took down her opponent, who is backed by the DSCC, she shocked the world. And now she's going to be running against, in November, former U.S. Ambassador to Japan, Bill Hagerty, who won the Republican primary. So he is not an incumbent. So he doesn't have that incumbency name ID. So there is a real race here now. Now, what does this mean? I think that we have something special that's happening here. This is just my my armchair analysis. I think what we're seeing across the country in these primaries, especially the recent primaries, since the BLM organizing and uprising across the country, and since states started to figure out how to handle the mechanics of vote by mail, what we are seeing is more people vote. And what we are seeing is communities who have been impacted by police brutality, who've been impacted, were on the front lines of the economic crisis and the health crisis from the COVID-19 pandemic. Communities that have already been hurting prior to Trump, from 30 years of neoliberalism, from listening to what the Democrats think are their priorities, from being avoided, ignored, incarcerated, from food deserts to medical deserts to high medical costs, lack of proper funding of schools. You know what's happening across the country right now in rural communities, in cities. There is a lack of funding, of resources, of health care, of clean water. People are working extra hard. We know that folks, working people, whether you're a nurse or a teacher, or you work at your local Walmart, which is sometimes one of the biggest employers in a small town and rural communities, benefits are being cut across the board. People are being impacted right now, whether you work in a frontline community when it comes to the COVID crisis, or you're forced to work at home and you have to teach your kids because schools are shut down and there's no answer, or you're worried that your schools might be open and COVID might be coming through your community again. These are the concerns, these are the stresses that so many Americans are facing, and they've had enough. So number one, I think that we're going to see an anti-incumbency year. We're going to see people fed up with incumbents who have not been able to speak and be there for their communities. Number two, more people are going to be voting. And what does that mean? So I love it when Democrats yell at Republicans for wanting to suppress the vote, for not wanting to invest in voting and recruitment, for voter restrictive measures. But then when it comes to a primary, the Democrats are against open primaries. Well, this is what happens when you have an open primary, when people can vote, whether they're registered or they have an opportunity to register ahead of the vote, when people don't have to take off from work and potentially miss voting or find childcare. Suddenly, they've got a ballot at home and they can do some research. They have an opportunity to fill it out, send it in. That's why the Postal Service is so important. Suddenly, more people are voting. So we are seeing a massive increase in voting turnout, in voter turnout across the country. And then what we're also seeing is a massive turnout of voters from underserviced communities that are fed up. And the last thing that we're seeing is voters want to see women, women of color, and in particular, Black women lead. So I think when you look at a state like Tennessee, which a lot of Democrats write off and say, oh, it's not worth our time. I don't know why. We had a senator that was a Democrat 30 years ago who sat in the White House. He was a vice president. He was our nominee for the Democratic presidency against George W. Bush. I don't know why Tennessee is off the map. Is it really off the map, or they just don't care? There are two major cities in Tennessee. There are Memphis is a majority minority city. Why don't we want to invest in Tennessee full force? And when the Democrats decide they do, it's with wealthy white male candidates. So she has made history. Markeitha Bradshaw is an organizer. She's a nurse. She believes in the Green New Deal and Medicare for all. And she stunned the world by getting the nomination of the Democratic Party. Now, I want to see if the DSCC shows up for her, because they were ready to show up for her opponent. $2 million is not a lot of money for them to raise. $4 million isn't. I want to see them step in for her the way that they say they believe in black women. They say they believe in winning the Senate back. Every Senate seat should count right now when it's this close. And for the DSCC to help provide the infrastructure for her, we could not see a more clear difference between the Republican and the Democrat on that ticket. And I think that that will mobilize people across the state who may have had to take off from work to vote in the past, but now are going to get a paper ballot. I think they're going to be motivated to support her. They're going to feel that she is there for them. They're going to hear her voice. And if you haven't checked her out, go check her out right now. She is passionate. She is lively. She is deeply rooted in the community. She's an organizer and an activist. And I cannot wait to see Markeitha Bradshaw in the Senate. And with her, I think we're going to win the Senate back. This race defied all the rules. And I love looking at these races. I have never seen anything like it. And I think that this is going to keep going. So, fascinating election cycle. Go check out Markeitha Bradshaw. She really broke all the rules, but it's significant and it's part of a trend. People want progress. Civi is an app that helps you find the politicians that best align with your beliefs. Whether quarantining at home alone or with family, it's as if it were the holidays. Gone are the days of no politics at the dinner table. We talk about our positions and express our support of politicians that we believe support our ideals. But in truth, how can we be sure that they actually do? There is a lot of noise out there. And recently, it feels like our assumptions about the world are being challenged every day. Civi is an app here to help you navigate the world of information around you, to help you better grow, develop, and understand your political leanings and where you fit in today's political landscape. Their algorithm fills the content based on your stances, shows you leaders who actually match your values, and independent media to help keep you informed. The more you use it, the better it grows. Find Civi on iTunes today. Our next guest just published a jaw-dropping piece in The New Republic. He is an investigator and outreach associate at the Government Accountability Project, Zach Coplin. He has worked as an investigative reporter. He's been an advocate for science and education issues. But this piece is a little bit different. I really don't even know what to say. My jaw literally dropped. The title of the piece is How Taxpayer Dollars May Have Bought a Kurdish Strongman's Beverly Hills Mansions. Yes, that's the government we're dealing with. I don't even know how you uncover this, Zach. Thanks for joining the show. Yeah. Okay, well, I guess we should just start. You're welcome. We should start off with the fact that, like, how do you learn this? How did you uncover this story?
So this goes back a ways, and my background is not or was not originally Iraq-related work at all. But I have been doing a lot of kind of specializations and investigations in the last few years. And we were working with whistleblowers from an American company called Sallyport Global Services, which runs one of the largest military bases in Iraq. And they were involved in human rights abuses, a bunch of waste and fraud, And they obtained their contract at the base through paying bribes to a company controlled by Iraq's former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. So I worked on that story for about 2 years, and I bumped into a different company on this base that was called Kairat al-Watan, and it was a fuel subcontractor on the base. And originally, we thought it was Maliki-linked because it had some sort of ties to the other contractors we were looking at. But it turns out it's actually owned by a Kurdish entity. And Iraqi Kurdistan is a semi-independent part of northern Iraq. It's nominally under control of the central government, but it has its own government. And for years has been essentially pushing to form its own more or less independent sub-region, if not complete independence. And so the key figures there are two big families, the Barzanis and the Talabani families. The Barzanis run the party that controls the region's capital of Erbil, called the KDP. And the Talabanis run another party called the PUK. That company actually that we were looking at is owned by neither of these parties. It's owned by kind of went like the third family in the region called the Bradostis. And they essentially play a broker between both parties and other factions. And they were getting, basically they were getting all sorts of oil deals through another American company called DGCI, which again, there's all sorts of kind of acronyms. And this is not an easy subject to unravel. It took us from start to finish, I'd say, probably 15 months for that story to be the end product here. And this company was getting $10 a gallon fuel contracts to deliver fuel to the U.S. government at the Erbil airport,
that's the airport in Kurdistan.
Yeah, it's the main airport in the capital. Yep. And there's a U.S. military base on that airport. Along with that, it's also a staging area for fuel deliveries into Syria. So,
does the U.S. government rent the airport space?
I actually don't know that, but I would guess it's leased to them by the Kurdish government, or they have permission to operate there. But anyway, whoever controls that airport controls all the fuel coming to the U.S. military in the city and into Syria. So there's a lot of money there, and there's even more money if you can charge absurd rates. And so for context, bulk fuel in Iraq, jet fuel, which is what they're delivering along with other fuels, was going for about $2.30 a gallon at that time, and potentially even less because during COVID we had a massive fuel price collapse. So you could argue this was a 400 to 500% inflation of the price for the fuel. And it's not like this is a place that's especially hard to get fuel. This isn't, there's no particularly difficult logistics challenges. Like the rest of Iraq is getting fuel for substantially cheaper. Why is this so expensive? It's not actually going through a war zone. Like no, they're just delivering to an airport.
It's a fuel. Yeah. I mean, this is a state that produces fuel. It's not,
yeah,
Egypt that doesn't have access to yeah, oil versus like Libya, no, for instance.
It's interesting. I mean, some of the fuel was domestically produced. We don't know exactly how much, and some of it was also shipped in. But either way, again, the prices were outrageous. And so, I had sources for years going, how are these companies getting these prices? And the answer, obviously, is corruption. Where we got a hold of a memo from the Kurdish government in Erbil, which outlined that only companies associated with the Barzani, or basically companies we linked back to the Barzani family, and also to this company, Zozik, we were looking at, which is kind of, again, one of those power brokers.
Who is the Barzani family? Just to give a context.
To give context, there's Masoud Barzani, who's the family's patriarch, and he was in charge of Kurdistan until a failed independence referendum. Then you've got one wing of the Barzani family, which is the president, and that is a guy named Netrivan Barzani. And we weren't this, and there's kind of two wings of the family in power. So you've got Netrivan, the president side, and then you've got the other side, which is the prime minister, Masrur Barzani, who, and these guys were all brothers and cousins. And so Masrur, the prime minister, and then his brother, Mansour, who was the head of the special forces. And so we were looking at Mansour and Masrur in this story. And they owned, or Mansour owned directly this company called Rain Floods, which was one of the subcontractors. And then another subcontractor was called Triple Arrow. And that was shared between that company. We're looking at Zozik, which is the other, another of those big families, again, the Bredostes. It was shared between, so that company and that family, and then the American contractors company, DGCI, which won the actual U.S. government contract at $10 a gallon. So again, these things
And when you say they won a contract, I mean, we're supposed to have these open bidding processes, just to kind of explain it to our audience. Yes. So how did they get this bid? Who are they bidding from? What's the process of all that?
Yeah. So they won the bid through a Department of Defense agency called the Defense Logistics Agency, and their energy branch. And there was no, again, bidding is supposed to be open, but the reality of military contractors, like, roughly, there was a study that actually came out on this recently, and it's about 50% of military contracts are actually not open bids. There's something called sole source, which means that you probably can intuit there was one source for the bid, either because only one company had the technology or only one company was able, like largely through corruption, I think, enables these things because they're the only companies allowed by the regional powers to do the job. So that's what's in this case, is they were the only company who could deliver fuel to this airport. Other companies tried, and the U.S. government tried to get other companies to do it. We don't know who this company was because it's redacted in government documents, but apparently one company actually broke through the airport fence to deliver fuel to the U.S. government, which the Kurdish government was very displeased by, and permanently banned that, whoever this company was.
So it was a company that was defying the Kurdish government to deliver the fuel to the U.S. government. So it's, they're not necessarily working together on this.
One was a one-time thing, and the Kurdish government clearly said, basically, this will never happen again. You're using these companies we picked. And it didn't. And the U.S. government from then on used this company, DGCI, at prices above reasonable rates. And they wrote, I mean, if you go, we posted some of the article and on Document Cloud, and they're also just very available in government contracting databases. You can read, the government just says, we tried to hire other companies. No one else could deliver the fuel. This winter, they actually tried to hire two other companies. And again, those companies couldn't deliver the fuel. So they had to go back to this company, DGCI, again, at these high $10 gallon, $8 to $10 gallon prices, because it became an emergency. And that was what happened. And it happened because the Kurdish government restricted access to all but companies connected with this network. And again, it's extremely convoluted. The entire point is to disguise this from the U.S. government, from the FBI, who's investigating this, from people just looking at it and going, this is wrong. Like, it's shell company after shell company. They've switched them out all the time. They apparently made new ones in response to the story to just kind of keep all this going.
What is the Secretary of State? Like, there's this picture of Mike Pompeo with Barzani, leader of the Kurdish Democratic Party, is that correct? In which they met. Are they aligned? Is the Trump administration, do they seem to be secretly part of these deals, or is it?
So with this one, I actually do not know. But when it comes to Pompeo, and just taking a digression from the deal, this specific deal, there's also big news that came out in between when this article that I wrote about the houses, which we haven't got, which is another, again, very convoluted, but it eventually leads to what could be money laundering inside the United States. But taking a digression from that, we have another deal that actually directly involves Pompeo that just took place in Iraqi Kurdistan and Syria, where Trump has said, we're going to take the oil from Syria and that's being implemented through a sketchy shell company called Delta Crescent, which is based out of Delaware, but consists of several of a military contractor with civil rights violations issues, a former Bush era ambassador to Denmark, and a oil exec with ties to the Assad regime in Syria. So it's kind of the sketchy group that has the only waiver from the U.S. government to be able to operate in Syria without facing sanctions. And the scheme.
Why is that? Why is it able to get through without sanctions?
Well, four companies applied for these waivers. Only this one company got it. And I can't. I mean, we can speculate on the reasons why this one company was special. I have some guesses. I can't tell you for sure. What I can tell you is that Mike Pompeo and senior level officials in the State Department were involved in negotiating with the Iraqi Kurdish government, likely to help this company export its fuel from Syria. The plot apparently originally was to export this fuel from Syria through a Iraqi Kurdish pipeline into Turkey. And this would cause a massive problem with Turkey because Turkey considers this fuel terrorist fuel.
Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, this plan.
It seems like the U.S. government is essentially, the Trump administration, yeah, I should say, is double dealing here.
Yes.
Okay.
So we got pictures of the heads of this company dealing with the Barzani family, with Netrivan Barzani specifically and his chief of staff. And then my sources told me that the State Department officials were also meeting with Netrivan to discuss this company, which, again, this is all, we don't know exactly what was discussed, but putting two and two together, it seems like they're lobbying on behalf of the export route. Or negotiations over who buys the fuel. So there's definitely relationships there.
How does this relate to the housing?
Yeah.
Because just to tie in, factor I think a lot of, we talk about this a lot on our show,
yeah,
U.S. real estate right now, actually globally, in big cities, maybe up until COVID, we don't know what's going to happen now, but
yeah,
a lot of properties around the country that are being bought and sold, but bought in particular, it's being used to house money that is supposedly safer than putting it in banks or Swiss banks, mm-hmm, or wherever, a lot of these folks used to hide their money so that it wouldn't be tracked. And
yeah,
they find that they can pay for an apartment or two or three or four in cash,
yeah,
and it keeps their money safe.
Exactly.
And tax-free too.
Yeah.
What a great addition. So,
and
which has consequences locally, of course, and undetected. So,
yeah,
the effects on that are obviously could be,
yeah,
the housing market is inflated and there's lots of other domestic issues. But just to tie it to this story,
yeah,
how did you figure this out? Because it is very hard to detect.
So I was actually very lucky for the work of another reporter at Variety who figured the first half of this out last fall. Basically, two of the most expensive houses in Beverly Hills were sold in 2018, one for $22 million and one for $27 million. These are huge mansions. And they were bought by an anonymous shell company. One was out of Delaware and one was out of Virginia. And both those places, Delaware, of course, is the kind of pinnacle of hiding your assets and hiding ownership of companies in the United States. In Virginia, you have the ability to also hide ownership. It's not as, or it's easier to slip up, I would say, in Virginia, but it's still
it
a place
be,
you can hide.
It has to be linked, like your LLC has to be,
yeah,
linked to an actual address, not like some sort of,
yeah,
mystery mailbox that houses like 9,000 addresses.
Yeah. And sometimes when you have a proxy owner, like I've seen the Barzanis actually did exactly this, where they had a proxy owner through an anonymous shell company. But then when they renewed their shell company, the person who signed off on it revealed their name for another house that they had hidden money in, not necessarily related to these oil deals, just kind of more dirty money that the family had. So that was kind of the piece of it. But it was done by a lawyer named Sam Garbia. And Garbia runs kind of a boutique law firm in Virginia that mostly is involved in like companies that own gas stations. But he has a couple of weird connections. And one of these connections is a company called Repeat Consultants, and Repeat Consultants International, which is its Kurdish branch. And Repeat Consultants is run by a guy named Haval Dosky. And Dosky actually, the Variety reporter traced Dosky back to the houses that that were bought in California. And Dosky's background is apparently he's a close personal friend of Mansour Barzani and an employee of his. And that's, again, that's the head of the special forces and brother of the prime minister and cousin of the president in Kurdistan and son of the former president. So again, very, very well connected and tied to these oil deals. And so with Dosky's involvement in the houses, he then said these are probably Barzani houses, and then confirmed that the significant other of a member of the Barzani family, a woman named Sodi Koshtaman, was also occupying one of the houses for a time and had a kid who had a Barzani last name living in the house. So we've got these houses. We now know they're Barzani houses. And then what's really interesting to me is this guy Dosky. So I was leaked. Not only was I leaked these airport approval documents that showed that only these companies linked to the politicians and to the American company that had the overpriced contract were allowed, but it had another company name that was allowed to operate in the airport. And that was this company, Repeat Consultants International, which is owned by Dosky. So you have again, dirty, overpriced deals that look like corruption, political figures involved. And then you have the middleman for property that, again, and when you're looking at this property, right, like when you're thinking about a politician in a foreign country buying $50 million of U.S. property, their salary is maybe $400,000, official salary, right, is $400,000 U.S. Where did they get $50 million? Like, it's like, yes. When you start looking at these things, like this money is not supposed to be there. So where do they spend this money?
Where do they put their money? You know, yeah. Like they're making all this money in cash. Yeah. Where do they put the money that's untraceable and can't be seized by a change in government or whatever it is?
Yeah. And so, so you've got those questions where like there's these weird purchases, where did the money come from? And then now we have this link back to money that was essentially stolen from the U.S. government. And we don't know exactly the flow of money, what came into Dosky from the U.S. military's fuel purchases and what went out to these houses, which he allegedly bought for the Barzani family. Like we haven't seen inside his bank accounts. But
and when you say
there's
like
a good chance
stole, you literally mean like this inflated the inflation of fees, essentially.
Yeah. I mean it's money that shouldn't have been paid. I mean, when you're if I go to the gas station, I mean, exactly. This is how a lot of these schemes go. I mean, I've heard stories about, for example, U.S. generals who retired and were handing bags of cash to Iraqi officials. Is a thing that happens, but there's also a lot more savvy schemes than just like a briefcase of cash. It's you're my partner, and we give you 40% of our deal or 60% of our deal, and since you're the government, no one else can operate. You can kind of charge the fees you want and mark up rates. That's still bribery, even if it's done through a method that's not a bag of cash.
So who do you think was motivated to leak this information to you? Is there a sense that there's an opposition locally? Is it an international aspect, American?
So you tend to see there's a mix. A lot of times what I've seen is the local opposition does have bits and pieces of what's going on. Certainly not the full picture because again, these things are disguised. And then you've got a lot of people who work for these companies on both the Iraqi and the American side generally are willing to talk. And the reality is that kind of the little guys get screwed all the time. Where you stumble into something bad and you're the first one fired, or you're working for a company in another and this is something you see especially in Iraq where a lot of people are just trying to make it work and they're working and some of the best money you can make is working for the Americans, and so they've got a stable job being an engineer or something, and then another faction comes in and kicks out the faction that employed them and fires everyone and puts their own people in place. And And a lot of people feel screwed essentially by the system being so corrupt and allowing that to happen. So there's some discontent there. And then a good bit of it is once we had the initial clues, basically these, I knew very early on the scheme of this, right? Where I've been told this is, these companies are owned by these politicians and these companies and these contracts are massively overpriced. And it became, how do I prove that these companies are owned by the politicians? Because of course they're hiding this, and figuring out who owns a company in Iraq is not always the easiest task. Especially again, because no one puts it, it's not like when you find companies have to register themselves. When you find the registration, it's not like politician X has signed it and said, this is my company. It's going to be like the employee of his brother's cousin. And so it becomes a task of finding out who owns the company and then how they're actually related to the politicians that everyone says they're related to. And that was what took us literally a year. And the key breaking point on this actually came, it's one thing I really like doing, is tracking phone numbers. And so we found a corporate registration, my organization found a corporate registration for this company, Triple Arrow, which was one of the middleman companies. And it had a name on it and a phone number. And I was like, and the name was Ali Hashim, which is just like, it's super generic. Like, you're not gonna be able to find anything about this. But I knew there was, but I did find an Ali Hashim who was working for the company that I was trying to connect him to, this the bigger company called Zozik. And I was like, okay, it's totally this guy. Like, I know it. How do I prove it? And managed to basically find that his phone number, you can search phone numbers on Skype. So I threw his phone number into Skype, found a username. That username was his email. And that email was associated with a LinkedIn account that was the guy I thought he was. And I was like, okay, bingo, there we go. That's proof that this guy is, and again, then he's employed by the people who are partners of the president and, or the prime minister's family. And at that point, you can start to make the links together and say, okay, this company is a politically controlled company and it's getting a $10 gallon contract. And then that's illegal. I mean, we have the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which says you cannot bribe foreign politicians. And I mean, these companies are run by people who are in, I mean, the FBI could go to McLean, Virginia right now and arrest everybody involved in these companies. Wow. And they might.
Just to wrap up here.
Yeah.
That is what's next. The FBI is essentially investigating, and then they could arrest, but not abroad, here in the U.S.
Yeah. I mean, they can arrest anyone who is an American citizen for sure. Who they can, and they could probably. I mean, I'm sure they would be happy to arrest other people if they could reach them. But mm-hmm. again, that's more complex. Obviously, you can't arrest a foreign leader. The State Department's not going to okay that. But the FBI is actively pursuing this company, DGCI. And I know that because apparently they're showing up at the houses of DGCI employees and asking questions. And in July, the company sent out to all its staff saying, hey, if an FBI agent shows up at your house, you don't have to talk and we'll get you a lawyer. So that's not a good, those are kind of the don't leave town visits when you get those. And so I would not want to be a senior manager. I mean, first off, I wouldn't bribe foreign leaders, but I wouldn't want to be in their shoes at this point.
Well, it's really fascinating because I'm curious where it leads, at least within our government, and how our government was involved in facilitating this especially. But Zach, super interesting piece. Zach Coplin is an investigator at the Government Accountability Project. His piece is up on The New Republic. We will link it out. It is fascinating. It is a great example of how corruption works. That model that you just kind of described can be international. It's local. Very similar models seem to be everywhere. So, Zach, hope you can come back. Let us know what happens. And it's really fascinating. I promised you guys that we would clear up the confusion around whether or not statehood is a right-wing agenda item or a left-wing agenda item because somehow the Democratic Party in the United States has created confusion over what's happening on the island of Puerto Rico. Well, we are very lucky to have former New York State Assemblyman and author of one of my favorite books of all time, The War Against All Puerto Ricans. And it is, seriously, it is a beautiful book. It's written like a spy novel, but it's based in history. It is just a stunning book, and so much work was put into it. Nelson Dennis, a friend, ally, thank you for joining.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So Nelson, you know, it's better coming from you since you've worked so much on this and you know the island so well, and you know the activists on the island and the history of activism. Can you just like give everyone the explanation as to how the, you know, what is the statehood situation? Why does everyone suddenly think that statehood is the solution for the island of Puerto Rico?
Well, frankly, I would admit that anything would be better than what we have now, because there's 73 billion reasons why the Commonwealth option is just, it's dysfunctional. And it was a chimeric from the beginning. It was just, you know, sort of a colonial tapestry. But the statehood issue has really been the raison d'etre. That's been the reason for these two parties to exist in the first place, because they define themselves in relation to the issue. So
the two parties being
PPD, PNP, Partido Popular Democrático, el Partido Nacional Progresista. And so the PNP is ostensibly for statehood. But a long time ago, it's about, in the 60s, a guy named Rubén Berríos wrote, he's one of the independents, top independence people. He wrote something that just made a lot of sense. It's a moot point because statehood is not going to happen. So then what's the point? So, and they know it. They have to. They can't be so idiotic on the highest levels because they know the approval process, and you'd have to get Congress to approve. Congress would have to approve.
United States Congress.
Yeah.
So is that why there's this bipartisan, I mean, just this week there was this proposed vote on this, right? That basically got knocked off the table. But you know, this is now essentially a bipartisan issue. Both Republicans in the U.S. House in Washington and Democrats in the U.S. House, the parties, seem to be for statehood, not unilaterally. Let's just make that very clear. Not everybody. But it is something that is you know, the official stance of the Democratic Party now, even though of the Puerto Rican lawmakers in the Congress, they do not agree with this as Democrats. So isn't that crazy that someone like Nidia Velázquez is against statehood, and she's in the Democratic Party, but the DNC has said, oh, we're not going to listen to our Puerto Rican delegation. We're just going to decide on our own that statehood is what we're for.
Yeah, well, Richie Torres weighed in very quickly.
Newly elected Richie Torres, just to be clear for the audience.
And what I would suggest to Richie, and this is not without it, with no cynicism involved, is that he wrote something in the New York Times that they probably solicited him. Yes, okay, Richie, if that's how you feel about cynicism, then do yourself and us a favor. Make it one of your key legislative issues. Propose it. Go ahead.
Propose statehood. So Richie Torres, for our audience, which is national, Richie Torres has not been elected yet. He just won a primary in the Bronx to replace Jose Serrano, who was the lawmaker there, who just stepped down and retired. So Richie Torres is a young lawmaker. He was a council member. He's been criticized for cozying up to AIPAC, even though he's supposedly progressive. And this is a very, the district has, you know, a lot of, in New York, South Bronx, a lot of Puerto Ricans. So he's afraid, essentially what you're saying is he's afraid of actually making it a specific proposal.
Well, no, I don't think that he's thought that through. I don't want to put words into, you know, but he certainly hasn't put it out. He hasn't, you know, filed a bill or co-sponsored, and he should. It's just put your money.
Well, he's not sworn in yet.
Yeah, well, I know, but he should. I know, but he hasn't talked about it. He gave no indication that he's building a ground. So I know, yes. I mean, but I'm saying he should prospectively, and then we'll see. You know, where it ends up. That's what he needs to do. Not just talk about it, and because here, let me just talk really quickly. I know the thumbnail. Politically, you're going to have There'll be about 5 or 6 Congress people, and it's a zero-sum game. You can add 2 senators, but you can't add Congress people. So 5 states will have to like willingly concede, and this, you know, highly contentious environment in Washington. You're not going to find 5 people who say, yeah, sure, take my wife, please. No, they're not going to concede that. So that's politically. Certainly the Republicans don't want these fire-breathing Democrat Latinos to also then become another much larger leveraging force in Congress, because a lot more Latinos will be able to work together. Economically, if they eliminate the Jones Act, which was one of the things that would happen, all consumer goods companies, car manufacturers, they have the Jones Act, you know, enables them to raise prices. The shipping companies wouldn't want that. The Teamsters Union wouldn't want it. And Wall Street is addicted to the triple tax exempt bonds. It's like fiscal crack for these people. And Puerto Rico would have immediate Chapter 9 bankruptcy access. It's too much. And the mortgage bond market is roughly about 17% of the United States economy. At any given point in time, 17% of the American economy is filtering through these instruments. And if Puerto Rico gets a Chapter 9 bankruptcy and renegotiates his debt, then all states are going to say, wait a minute, good for the goose, good for us too. And then if you have all 50 states seeking to renegotiate their debt, their mortgage bond debt, that will basically be the implosion of the mortgage bond market. Wall Street does not want that. They don't want that degree of instability. So if you have Wall Street, you know, all these consumer goods companies, the teams are economically against it, the Republican Party against it, it's just not going to happen. How's it going to happen?
So what I find interesting about this is just the campaign around it. If historically this has not really been popular on the island, like with real popularity, not these pseudo elections that they put forth in which they manipulate them. Let's just make that very clear. There's been a couple of situations in which there's been a vote, but it is, you know, the UN would not deem it an appropriate vote. Let's just put it that way. So if it's not popular on the island, and of course, you know, the Puerto Rican people should be the ones making this decision, not the American government, not the American Democratic Party or the Republican Party, and it's not likely to pass, why go through this dog and pony act? What's the point of this all?
Because as I mentioned earlier, that is the only reason for the existence of these parties in Puerto Rico, because that's how they define themselves. So if they can't keep that issue alive, then there's no real reason for having those two parties.
And like, to be fair, because a lot of people don't know this until they go there and they understand, the two parties are not like Democrat versus Republican. You know, there are people who identify as Democrat or Republican on the mainland, but have different party preferences on the island. It's confusing. So you had an elect. There's of course this election that's happening. The governor of Puerto Rico, Carmen Jolene Cruz, is running for governor, right? Mm-hmm. So she is. She is not for statehood. That's something very interesting. I think a lot of people would be surprised by that are not from the island, of course. So what are the dynamics happening now on the island?
Well, what Wanda Vasquez is doing, she's been really slick. She's been taking a whole lot of coronavirus money.
Say that one more time.
Wanda, the governor, Vasquez, she's been really slick. She's taken a lot of coronavirus money and it hasn't been distributed, hasn't filtered. So she's had this curfew. It's almost like an undeclared martial law. And what she's doing is basically is abrogating the First Amendment rights of people, because she's not letting people to assemble after 7 o'clock. So that plus the ballot that she's using has this one sentence question. Do you want Puerto Rico to be a state? Or it doesn't really go, it doesn't give very clear options. And so a lot of people, only PNP people are going to want to show up and vote for that. So a lot of people in the PPD, they're going to be disgusted, and they won't show up to vote at all. And that's exactly
what
they
did last time. That's what they did last time.
Yeah, so it's pretty slick. I mean, you know, this is it's like a puppet show. It's very naked. I'm sure Trump would love to, you know, be able to get away with some of that.
Well, the person who represents, okay, so the governor was forced to step down, who was a pro-statehood governor and also very close to Tom Perez and the Democratic Party and Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York. So he was seen conservative on the island and I guess more Democratic or neoliberal on the mainland. And so she took over for him. And there is this gubernatorial election. But then you have this this non-voting Congress member who actually sides with the Republican Party, who's also for statehood, who's in Congress. So let's briefly, in like 3 minutes, talk about the independence movement. Can you do that? And we'll have you back on to talk more in depth about your work in documenting the history of the independence movement. But does it exist today? Like, what's happening?
Yeah, it's alive and well. It hasn't really taken root because it had its apogee in the 40s, but in that time there was the Law 53, which made it a crime, a felony, to have a flag or to talk about independence. So it's very difficult for the Independence Party for you to vote, and people in these little towns, they know each other, and if you vote, you could go to jail if people find out that you voted for independence. So ever since then, it's just that it's never taken step. You know, there's a woman with a Ruth, she wrote the shock doctrine, the shock capitalism. What's her?
Naomi Klein.
Right. So Naomi Klein came up with something that's interesting. She coined the term multiple sovereignties. And that's something that I think could take away. Food sovereignty, energy sovereignty, little points of light that in the end aggregate to a de facto independence by virtue of the way that you live. And so that is something that I think that's viable that can be discussed. But independence Puerto Rico has been really difficult because it's like a Stockholm syndrome. Everybody's just caught up with a McDonald's and it's like in their veins now. It's very difficult.
The economy is too tied to these multinational corporations. Like, what are you going to do? Start printing your own money and become dependent?
And also, just the mentality. It's an unannounced Americanism that just, it's just this consumer. It's very difficult for you to renounce an entire way of life, and that's what they would need to do.
Well, Nelson, we're going to have you back on because I think if there's anybody here in the States, I should say in particular, who has a pretty deep understanding of the politics, the history, and the economics surrounding the island of Puerto Rico, which is the poorest in the country, poorest place in the country, far poorer than Mississippi, which is the poorest state. They're being taxed on all ends. It's just as expensive to live in on the island as it is to live in Manhattan. And of course, if the wages do not keep up with that, and of course, the vulture capitalists have swooped in every single time there's a disaster, whether it's a storm, economic crisis, and now with COVID, who knows what's going to happen. So, Nelson, I would love to have you back on to discuss this more, but sure. we had a short period of time, so we snuck it in. Check out Nelson's book. Great book, War Against All Puerto Ricans, and we'll have you on soon.
Okay, see you again.
Bye, Nelson. Thanks. Thanks for watching and listening to The Nomi Key Show. But remember to click like and subscribe on YouTube and please share on social media. If you're not already a patron, please join us for as low as $5 a month on patreon.com/The Nomi Key Show for early and special content. That investment makes a huge difference. We are not corporate media raking in the dough. It's really you guys that are keeping us going. So please consider being a patron. And to our current patrons, thank you so much. We are incredibly grateful to you. We also now have swag. So check us out on thenomikeyshow.com to get your mugs, your totes, and your stickers. The island of Puerto Rico, of course, is a colony. I think it's fair to say that, of the United States. They're constantly being dealt with bad hands, whether it's intentionally designed by the U.S. government, not helping them with infrastructure, providing resources, double taxing, keeping it the poorest in the country below the state of Mississippi, which is the poorest state in the country. And of course, they're constantly hit by hurricanes. Well, there's a domino effect. And our next guest has been working on a story for a while. Fascinating. It appeared in BuzzFeed. Adam Rhodes is an investigative reporter. This article is titled, As Puerto Rico Battles Hurricane Season, HIV-positive folks begin to brace for the worse. So Adam, first, thanks for joining us. How did you it's hard to say discover, because these are issues that are documented and very concerned, but what how did you learn about this crisis?
Okay, thank you so much for having me. So the first step in reporting this out is I went to go find HIV surveillance reports, which are reports that municipalities and governments make just tracking HIV in their jurisdictions. And what I found that, unlike in the mainland US, where the main vector of HIV has been through same-sex sexual contact. It has historically moved in Puerto Rico through injection drug use. They provided, in their surveillance reports, they provide like cumulative statistics, and the cumulative statistics showed that like out of all of the HIV and AIDS cases that have been diagnosed in Puerto Rico, which is a little bit above 50,000, they're 42% are tied to injection drug use. So like a huge amount of these diagnoses are coming solely through injection drug use. It's not injection drug use and same-sex sexual contact, which is another category. It's only injection drug use is that 42%.
So is this mainly due to the lack of infrastructure and like basically government crumbling after Hurricane Maria? Or was this a prominent issue before? Like, were there safe injection sites before? Were there functioning hospitals, of course, before mm-hmm. the storm that really have not been able to revive themselves?
Mm-hmm. A lot of people said this is actually kind of a historical issue on the island. I think if you look at all of the political uncertainty on the island, just like being a colony, having inadequate representation in Congress, not being able to vote for the president, all of that, a lot of people said that when you're faced with that political turmoil and you really aren't responsible or you aren't given the ability to really manage your own future, then they are turning to other ways to kind of cope with that. And that in one of those ways happens to be injection drug use.
So injection drug use meaning like their way of coping with the problems on the island is literally to take drugs. Okay, got it. Mm. But there's no infrastructure in terms of like safe injection sites. I mean, in like no. New York City, they've invested quite a bit in this.
Mm-hmm. No, so there aren't a ton, but there are those harm reduction groups. Like in the article I spoke with, Anissa Diva Comunitaria, and they do really amazing work. They like, even amid the pandemic, they're going out on needle exchanges with aid workers and handing like 20 clean needles, tourniquets, condoms, like things needed to safely inject drugs. But there really isn't a infrastructure designed in Puerto Rico like aimed at like addressing the injection drug, like injection drug use in general. It's just like kind of a phenomenon that in Puerto Rico kind of just happens without much government intervention.
Is there a sense of like how the drugs are, I mean, like why on the island? Why mm-hmm. now? Why not other forms of drugs?
Mm-hmm. So I don't have a ton of information about that, but I do, what they essentially told me is that the quality of drugs is going down on the island just because of everything happening, that the drugs that they are getting can be contaminated or they're not as clean or they're like cut with different things. So I don't know enough to like really say about like why injection drug use as opposed to like other types of drug use, but a lot of people that I spoke with said like it was essentially just like a slippery slope that like they might have started with like cocaine use or something like that, and it like eventually slipped to like crystal meth or heroin or something like that.
So in terms of medical care, I mean, first you have the medical care that's needed due to the drug use, to overdosing, et cetera. And then, of course, there's just HIV. How is the island coping with this right now?
So a lot of people on the island told me that it's really, really, really difficult to get quality HIV treatment, just like in general, whether it's getting their medication, whether it's just like making an appointment with a doctor, whether it's like really just having any semblance of stability in managing the HIV virus. I mean, like one person I spoke with, and this is before Hurricane Maria, this is before he left Puerto Rico for the mainland US in 2010. He said he had to get up at 4 a.m. every 3 months to make an appointment at a state hospital. But have to wake up in the morning at 4, go to the state hospital, write his name down like on a list of people like being seen, and then go back home, sleep for a couple hours, come back for his appointment at 9:30, and I think he said he would eventually leave at noon.
Wow. And this is partially because like they're, I'm not sure what his situation is, but like Medicaid they've not been receiving adequate funding for Medicaid. They haven't been receiving adequate support. Some of these hospitals, I mean, especially after a storm, where I don't even know how many of these hospitals were actually are fully functioning in that capacity right now. I mean, this is, especially with coronavirus, like how does this all overlap?
I think what a lot of the people that I spoke with said that they felt that they were kind of going to be left to the wayside, or just like left to the sidelines, just because like they felt like they weren't a priority right now with like the medical infrastructure, like because of coronavirus, because of all of the issues that come with like surviving dozens of natural disasters, like hurricanes. There's like a Sahara dust cloud in the past couple weeks. There's like those catastrophic earthquakes in 2017. So a lot of these populations that like their conditions might not be like emergency conditions that need to be like managed right then and there. Sometimes I guess they felt that maybe they were not like the medical priority at the time, or that because they're such a specialized medical population that they felt like a little niche and underserved in that way.
How about the doctor's crisis? That part, I almost not fell off my seat.
Truly. I think it's been a, again, like with everything, there's just like so many reasons for this. People fleeing Puerto Rico just because of the natural disasters, fleeing Puerto Rico to have better political representation in Congress. But then as the letter that I linked to in the article pointed out, that a lot of times people are just leaving because they're getting better job offers, and that they're getting job offers that actually pay them living wages and wages that they can sustain their family on.
So in other words, thousands of doctors have fled the island because they can find better paid work. And half the island do qualify for Medicaid. Let's just make that very clear. So in terms of a population, if half the island, and it's a pretty large, I mean, I don't know what the percentage, what the population is right now, but you know, it's roughly the size of New York City in terms of population prior to the storm. Of course, it's really hard to track right now because so many people go back and forth, but it's a very large island. To say half of the island qualifies for Medicaid and doctors are, I don't know what the private practices are like. So, I mean, are there any other like things that have popped out to you in terms of crisis and how the government, the U.S. government is responding?
I think, honestly, the biggest thing for me that I saw that really impacted the quality of HIV care on the island is really the just disinvestment from the American federal government. I think the fact that there is only a 55% medical or federal Medicaid assistance percentage, which is how much of the expenses, Medicaid expenses are paid by the federal government. And there are states that have lowered, I think the statutory minimum is 50, and there are states that have that 50, but like that's still only 50%. And when you think of like a specialized medical population, like people living with HIV, like those treatments are expensive. And so when you're only paying half of that, it's still going to add up for this population because they're not given as much assistance, very important and very needed assistance to manage this virus and to manage like the circumstances that they are being handed both by politicians and just by like the literal world.
I there's no way of describing how tragic and the cards that this island and the people of this island have been dealt over the last 100 years, more actually, but since the U.S. has been involved 120 years, whatever it is. Really interesting reporting. I mean, we on the show will be touching a lot on the island. It's a lot of the work I did in the last few years, and there's so many layers and aspects. And I think, you know, what it reveals is it's sort of a metaphor of underserved communities across the country, the world, of course, but it's a colonial mindset that we've put on an island that we're also doing in underserved communities and cities across the country, you know, which is essentially like gearing up for privatization, in my opinion. But Adam, really interesting work. Please keep us in the loop about future stuff. Thanks for putting this piece together. Much appreciated.
Great, thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Thanks to Adam Rhodes, Nelson Dennis, and Zach Coplin. And special thanks to Dorsey, Kelly, George, and Ruthie. And if you are not already, make sure to click like and subscribe on our YouTube show at The Nomi Key Show. Next week, August 17th, Monday through Friday, we're covering the DNC, the convention. We're going to break it down for you all. We're going to have great guests. 3 o'clock Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific. Write it down. Share it on social media. I promise you, you're going to get all of the insider information. I will not hold back. And then we're going to do it the following week with the Republican National Convention. Thanks to everyone. Stay safe, stay well, and we'll see you next week.